The Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1921 ended the War of Independence and led to the creation of the Irish Free State the following year, a state still tied in law to the British Crown. But within 16 years, that link had been almost entirely dismantled. By the time Éamon de Valera introduced Bunreacht na hÉireann, the 1937 constitution, Ireland was effectively a republic in everything but name, and just over a decade later, it became one in law as well. A new book called From Crown to Harp, How the Anglo-Irish Treaty Was Undone, 1921 to 1949, traces this remarkable bloodless revolution, exploring how Ireland quietly unpicked the treaty settlement through law, diplomacy and political will. The author is my guest, historian, author and broadcaster David McCullough, who joins me now in studio. Welcome back to the History Show, David.
Thanks very much, Miles. Thanks for having me.
Okay, before we get to the treaty itself, let's go back a bit. John Redmond, nationalist political leader, once said, "Our stake in the empire is too large for us to be detached from it." Go back even further. Daniel O'Connell wanted a kingdom of Ireland with Victoria as monarch. Given all that, what was Ireland's effective relationship with crown and empire in the years, let's say, leading up to World War One?
Complicated it would be the short answer to that. I think it's really interesting that a lot of nationalists in that time period saw the crown not as a problem, but as a solution, as a way of getting away from control from London, from British political control, that the crown as a symbol could remain as the link between the two islands, because nationalists recognised that there was an interrelationship between Britain and Ireland, which obviously subsists to this day. We have a common travel area where no other country in the EU has such a relationship with Britain. So they recognised that there needed to be some kind of a link, and it would be much better to have the link being the entirely ceremonial link of the Crown rather than a continuing political link with Westminster and Whitehall. So, you know, you look at the various visits by Queen Victoria, her son King Edward, and his son King George in 1911, and people turned out in their tens and hundreds of thousands to greet them, you know, which is a fact which is rather airbrushed over subsequently. So the people who were separatists, who wanted to cut all links with Britain, were a tiny, tiny minority, and they remained that way until...
And Arthur Griffith wasn't one of them.
No, because Arthur Griffith was talking, of course, about dual monarchy, Austria-Hungary. And he, in a way, it was a way of making it more palatable to Britain, to make home rule more palatable to Britain. Now, Griffith obviously was looking for more independence and more autonomy than would have satisfied Redmond. But the point remains that they saw that there was an interrelationship between these islands and that the only way to secure greater independence for Ireland was to recognise that link in some way.
OK, fast forward then, post-war, 1918, Sinn Féin and the 1918 general election. Obviously, they have a huge mandate. And the term dominion status is being tossed about around that period, 1918, 1919, 1920. Can you explain what it means and how attractive or otherwise it was to a resurgent Sinn Féin?
I can't explain what it means because nobody knew what it meant. And they, and the British, you know, they always go on about not having a written constitution and everything. They actually made a virtue of the fact that you cannot define dominion status. Dominion status is evolving. So what they meant by that was that there is a family of nations. This is the way they would have regarded it. Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa and Britain. And while Canada or Australia might pursue their own domestic policies and be in charge of whatever they did within that country, they still had a link. They were still part of the family. They still had a common, crucially common foreign and defence policy. And that made a lot of sense to, for instance, to Australia. Australia needed the protection of the Royal Navy and always would, and knew it had to maintain some kind of a link. So while the British were prepared, because of distance, because of practicalities, to let these dominions run their own domestic affairs, they made damn sure that they were still within the tent, because that's what gave Britain its imperial heft. So in terms of its appeal to Irish people, Sinn Féin, the demand was for a republic. I mean, Father Michael O'Flanagan, the vice president of the party, famously said after the 1918 election, "The people have voted for Sinn Féin. We must now explain to them what that means," because it wasn't entirely clear what a republic would mean and so on. But there was clearly a sense among a lot of people, even in Sinn Féin, even in the IRA, that dominion status might be enough, depending on how it was presented, depending on how it would work out. The fear was, and always was, that unlike the dominions, we are just across the Irish Sea from Britain, and therefore there would be a temptation to meddle in Irish affairs which wouldn't exist with Canadian or Australian or South African affairs. So there was some attraction for the idea, but at the same time there were people who worried that we wouldn't get what Australia and Canada got.
Now, after almost 3 years of war from 1919 to 21, how much of an advance were the terms of the Anglo-Irish Treaty as against the measure of Home Rule that did actually pass into law in 1914 but was suspended for the duration of the Great War?
You couldn't really compare them. I mean, there was a huge advance. As people sometimes say that the rise in the War of Independence wasn't necessary, that we had Home Rule and that would have developed. And it may have developed, we don't know. But there was still far more control under the Home Rule proposals than there were under what became the Irish Free State. You wouldn't have had control of your finances. You wouldn't have had control of your tariff policy. You wouldn't have had control of policing initially. You certainly wouldn't have had your own armed forces, defence forces. So Dominion status was a huge advance on what had been in the Home Rule Bill. It was a huge advance on what had been in the Government of Ireland Bill. It was a huge advance on even on the proposals that Lloyd George offered to De Valera in July of 1921, which De Valera turned down. There were still, the treaty negotiations led to advances. And in those advances, there are the seeds for the further progress that is made over the next few decades.
Was the Irish Free State then able to take any liberties in formulating the 1922 Constitution? Because that document, to some extent, was circumscribed by the Anglo-Irish Treaty.
It was, to a huge extent. Michael Collins's idea was, look, we've signed the treaty, we don't like it, but we have to accept it. So we'll draw up a constitution that will be as republican as possible and that will allow his opponents who had opposed the treaty to recognise that it really did give freedom to achieve freedom, as it, the phrase went. So he tried to make the constitution as republican as possible. It didn't mention the oath, for instance, the original draft that went over to London. It didn't mention the Governor General. It didn't mention the Crown. It didn't mention the King. That was all kept out. And his argument was, we've signed the treaty, we're bound by that, so we don't need to include all this stuff in the constitution as well. Now, what he'd also done at that time, of course, was to agree an electoral pact with Éamon de Valera, where the two halves of Sinn Féin would present a united front to the electorate and form a coalition government afterwards. And this sent the British into a frenzy. Particularly Winston Churchill, not a man for understating his position. He went absolutely nuts. And therefore, they said, well, even if there had been a way that we could accept a pushing of the boundaries in the Constitution, there's no way we can do that if you're not going to have a proper election with a real choice before the people. Therefore, we insist on the actual, the complete letter of the treaty being stitched into the Constitution. And that was a big problem, obviously, for Collins.
Given the status of former colonies like Australia and Canada, was the British desire to retain some measure of control over the fledgling Irish Free State, was it more a matter of security than of pure symbolism?
There was a security aspect to it, and you can see that in the three treaty ports. And in fairness, De Valera, for instance, recognised that that Britain did have legitimate security concerns. You only have to look at a map of the British Isles to see that if Ireland was in hostile hands, Britain couldn't be defended. So De Valera all along had been prepared to offer Britain security guarantees in the famous Cuban speech, Cuban interview when he was in America and so on. So he had been prepared to accept that Britain needed some security guarantees, but when the treaty was signed and he went into opposition, he conveniently forgot that previous pledge. So Britain felt that its security was guaranteed by the fact that it still had those three ports, Cove, Bearhaven and Lough Swilly, and also guarantees that in time of war it would be able to use whatever harbour and airfield facilities it needed in Ireland to protect not just Britain, but Ireland as well.
Crucial in all of this is something that often gets ignored. What was the purpose and significance of something called the Conference on the Operation of Dominion Legislation in 1929, which produced something called the Statute of Westminster?
This is the key to the whole thing. Okay, so you have to go back a bit to 1926, where Britain and the Dominions agreed what was called the Balfour Declaration, not to be confused with the one about Israel and Palestine.
Yeah.
But the Balfour Declaration basically said that the Dominions are equal. They are separate, they are independent, but they are bound by a common allegiance to the Crown. And then they got to work on what does this mean in practical terms. So they had a meeting on the operation of Dominion legislation, which was made up of lawyers and politicians as well. And they looked at all the different pieces of legislation that bound the empire together, if you like. And the net result of that was the Statute of Westminster, which basically legally declared that Westminster was no longer supreme over the Dominion legislature. So the Dominions could pass legislation even if it conflicted with British law. And that was a big change. Some of the Dominions, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, had stitched into this Statute of Westminster that their constitutions couldn't be changed without approval from London. And the reason for that in Canada's case was that French Canadians were really worried that the English speaking majority would oppress them if they had the ability to be. And they saw Westminster involvement as a protection for their rights as a minority. So the Statute of Westminster is absolutely crucial because it allows the Free State to unpick the treaty. And De Valera recognised that, in fairness, when he came back into government. So an analogy which I've thought of since I wrote the book, unfortunately, if you think of the empire as a locked room, the Statute of Westminster unlocks the door. But Cumann na n-Éill do not walk through that door because they see Ireland's future, the Free State's future within the empire. De Valera walks through the door, but he doesn't shut the door behind him. He leaves a bridge to the Commonwealth because he wants to leave a bridge for unionists. And then it takes a further government in 1948, 1949 to shut the door behind them and finally end the link with the Commonwealth.
OK, so we come to De Valera. He takes power in 1932. Did the British anticipate problems when De Valera becomes, he wasn't Taoiseach. I think he
president
was president
of the
Executive Council. Same difference.
Oh, yeah. They J.H. Thomas, who was the Dominion Secretary, in one of the most remarkable understatements I've ever seen, said, if De Valera is elected, it could cause us some problems. So they were expecting trouble. They regarded De Valera as a madman, as an extremist, as irrational. They got in a doctor in Leopardstown Park Hospital, wrote to them at one stage saying that he had, as a psychiatrist, he had the special skills necessary to deal with somebody like De Valera. And they saw him as a firebrand. And in fairness to Eamon de Valera, none of that was true. He was entirely rational. He was entirely logical. He followed a very methodical course. He didn't do any more at any stage than he had told the electorate he was going to do. And he proceeded very logically on his course. And the problem, though, was that he seemed to have been a little bit surprised at how strongly the London reacted when he said he was going to get rid of the oath and when he said he was going to withhold the land annuities. The land annuities are interesting. These are payments made by farmers to repay the loans that have been used to buy the land, buy out the landlords. And the British knew that they were on a very dodgy wicket legally with this, that De Valera actually had a very good argument to make. So they refused to raise the suggestion of arbitration because they thought they might lose. So they hit back with the duties on cattle, which caused all sorts of problems to the Irish economy in the 1930s, the economic war.
Yeah, that was the economic war. So what impact did that have on the process of unpicking the treaty?
The problem was that the British were quite prepared to come to a settlement on all of these things, but they wanted to settle them all together. So they would do a deal over the land annuities. They weren't that pushed about the money. It was important in the context of the 30s, but it wasn't that important. They would do a deal about the treaty ports. But the price for that was De Valera accepting the crown and De Valera accepting a place for the Irish Free State within the Commonwealth. And that was something that De Valera was not going to do. So when De Valera, you mentioned Bunreacht na hÉireann, when De Valera produced that, the British looked at it and said it, with rather tortuous logic, that it didn't represent a break with the Commonwealth, that they would accept Ireland's continuing membership in the Commonwealth. So they were able to say that Ireland was still in the Commonwealth. De Valera was able to say that Ireland was no longer in the Commonwealth. So both sides were happy. And once he had done that and removed the crown from the constitution, abolished the Governor General and all of that, once he had done that, then the solution to the economic war and the treaty ports could be arrived at, because there was nothing to argue about. The other issues weren't as important to the British and they'd lost on the main one.
So, you know, as I said in the introduction, in effect, Ireland had become a republic, or had it, within 37.
Well, I know that that is what Fianna Fáil said at the time and said when the republic was declared in 1949, and people in Fianna Fáil are still saying it. Ireland, in effect, was a republic. It had a republican constitution, though it didn't say that. It had a president. It didn't have, the crown wasn't mentioned anywhere in the constitution. But De Valera's remaining link with the Commonwealth was called the External Relations Act, under which diplomatic documents for Irish diplomats were signed by the king. So if, as Joe Walsh did in 1946, you rock up to the Vatican as the new Irish ambassador to the Holy See and you present your letter of accreditation, the Vatican are looking at it and it's signed by King George VI. So is Ireland an independent state or is it still part of the British Empire? Clearly, to foreign countries, it was still regarded as being part of the British Empire. And the tests of sovereignty are, one, do you control the territory which you claim? And when the treaty ports were handed back in 1938, De Valera could absolutely say that we controlled every inch of the 26 counties. But the second test, the crucial test, is your sovereignty recognised internationally? And if it's not recognised internationally, if there is still this link with the British Crown, you're not fully sovereign. And therefore, I don't think you can argue that you really were a republic in the eyes of the rest of the world. And that's why what happened in 1948 and 1949 is important.
But what happened in 1948 and 1949 comes across almost as an afterthought.
It does come across as an afterthought in a lot of the writing about that period. I read John Bew's really good biography of Clem Attlee, a superb book, and it doesn't get mentioned. There's a lot of talk about India, because India obviously was a huge subject. I was over in Kew in the British Public Records, National Archives, and I called up a couple of documents, and what arrived were two really substantial volumes, red-bound volumes containing memoranda, minutes of meetings, all that sort of stuff. And one was about India, and that's okay, you can accept that, and how India became a republic. The other volume, of similar size, and indication that it was of similar importance to the Attlee government, is about Ireland. It's about Ireland leaving the Commonwealth. So to Attlee at that time, and to his colleagues at that time, Ireland, what happened in Ireland was a really, really big deal, partly because it impacted on India, but partly because Irish membership, continuing Irish membership of the Commonwealth, for what it was worth at that stage, which wasn't really very much, I think, was crucial to the future development of the Commonwealth. And they worried that if you diluted the Commonwealth link to the lowest common denominator, so it could include Ireland as well as India, that the link would be, in effect, useless, that the Commonwealth would be a talking shop and nothing more. Some people would argue that that, in fact, is what happened.
Now, you're right that there was much comment at the time when Ireland became a republic, courtesy of John A. Costello, the new Taoiseach, about partition casting a shadow over all of that, and that this was apparently the reason that Fianna Fáil boycotted the celebrations when the Republic came into effect in 1949. Was that the real reason why Fianna Fáil boycotted?
I think it was peak rather than that. I mean, it was convenient. It was a convenient excuse. I mean, the really interesting, or one of the really interesting things to me about all of this, about De Valera's constitution, about the Declaration of the Republic, about W.T. Cosgrave's government putting up border posts and all the rest of it, every time they asserted the sovereignty of the 26 counties, they deepened the ditch on the border. And I think that's true of all of those governments in that period. And I mean, De Valera didn't put a tooth in it during the war. That Fianna Fáil Ardeshi said there are two rights for the Irish people. One is to unity and the other is to sovereignty, and we are not going to dilute one of those rights in order to get the other. So in other words, he wasn't prepared to have less sovereignty, to have more of a link with the Crown in order to bring about Irish unity. And I think that is true of all governments in that period.
Well, it's an extraordinary story about how Ireland managed step by step to unpick the Anglo-Irish Treaty without a shot having to be fired. What seemed impossible in 1921 was achieved through pressure, skill, certain amount of luck. You could almost coin the phrase, the freedom to achieve freedom had somebody already not taken it. The book is called From Crown to Harp, How the Anglo-Irish Treaty Was Undone, 1920 to 1949. It's published by Gill Books. The author is my guest, David McCullough. David, many thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Miles.